The New Deal, Part 1. When Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in as president in 1933, he had promised during the campaign that resulted in his election to adhere to the traditional democratic nostrums of limited government, low taxes, and states' rights. But instead of pursuing a traditional Jeffersonian, Jacksonian democratic program, of course, Roosevelt soon would launch out on a new path, which he described as the New Deal. The New Deal first round included passage of several congressional bills transferring power from state governments to the federal government and from the Congress to the executive branch. This was going to lead to a serious confrontation between the elected branches of the federal government and the Supreme Court. In the first round of Supreme Court considerations of the New Deal measures, there were several Supreme Court decisions striking down important New Deal acts. Among those were 1935's Panama Refining Company case and Schechter Poultry case. In those cases, which were decided by votes of 8-1 and 9-0, with Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes and Justice Louis Brandeis in the majority in both cases, the National Industrial Recovery Act, which was a centerpiece of New Deal economic legislation, was held unconstitutional. That act had purported to empower President Roosevelt to set income amounts and prices, outcome amounts and prices, various conditions of labor and wages and so on, and ultimately the court said that this was an unconstitutional delegation of power to the president, who after all was not supposed to be America's chief policy maker, but was supposed to be the chief executive. It was also, the court said, unconstitutional regulation of intrastate commerce, because the court had for a long time adhered to the old distinction between interstate commerce and intrastate commerce. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution includes a listing of most of Congress's powers, and among the powers that Congress has delegated in Article 1, Section 8 is the power to regulate commerce among the states, interstate commerce. But intrastate commerce, things that happened within states, were left to the states to regulate or not. The court said in these early New Deal cases that the Congress had been incorrect in assuming that it had power over intrastate matters, and continued to adhere to the traditional federalism jurisprudence, really, that had been traceable all the way back to Thomas Jefferson's arguments and James Madison's arguments against Alexander Hamilton's bank bill in the House of Representatives in 1791 and in the Cabinet in 1791, and arguably even further than that, all the way back to the description of the Constitution that was offered by its Federalist proponents in the ratification conventions beginning in 1787. The next year, 1936, saw another very significant anti-New Deal decision handed down by the Supreme Court, this time in the case of United States versus Butler. And in that case, which one contemporary legal scholar called the worst case in Supreme Court history, but which I think was probably one of the best reasoned cases of the 20th century, the court said that the 10th Amendment banned the Agricultural Adjustment Act. The Agricultural Adjustment Act was an attempt to regulate agricultural production because the New Dealers had decided that what needed to be done was that Congress needed to try to prop up agricultural prices. So the American people, many of them were suffering through unemployment, standing in bread lines, standing in soup lines, and there's your helpful Congress trying to make sure that prices don't fall too low. Of course, it's a natural response of the market to fall in demand that prices go down, but Congress then, as the political class now, was working as hard as it could to keep prices high artificially rather than let them fall to market levels. So the Agricultural Adjustment Act was an attempt to regulate prices, keep them artificially high, and the court said that the Commerce Clause did not give the Congress power to do any such thing. The court also in 1936 continued along the line it had launched upon several decades before in insisting that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment established a general liberty of contract, and that was the court's phrase for it, a liberty of contract, and that this liberty of contract banned the states from certain kinds of economic regulation. Now, what's the issue here? Well, the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment is that part of the 14th Amendment that says that a state may not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And you might think, if you were not acquainted with the Supreme Court's reasoning about this provision, that it had to do with providing people the traditional adversarial process of Anglo-American law before subjecting them to execution, imprisonment, or a fine, that is, depriving them of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. But the court and federal courts generally, over the last century and more now, have been in the business of insisting that not only does this guarantee people will be able to avail themselves of the traditional Anglo-American legal process before being punished, but that it also establishes various substantive rights instead of procedural rights that people are entitled to and that can't be violated. So one of those was supposed to be the liberty of contract, which, note, is not found anywhere in the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, and besides that, is not something that was mentioned in the discussion of the 14th Amendment in Congress or in the ratification processes in the several states. Anyway, New York State had adopted a minimum wage law, as was very common in the Depression. So again, we have falling demand, we have falling prices for what? For labor. And where people are unemployed, you would expect the average wage of people who remain employed to fall, but New York decided in its wisdom that it would ban the hiring of people for less than a certain floor wage. And the court said in Moorhead versus New York, ex rel. Tipaldo in 1936, that this was unconstitutional. So here we have a kind of ruling that the court has handed down several times in the previous few decades, and the court continues on this line of thinking in 1936. It's not only striking down what were unconstitutional congressional attempts to intervene in the economy, but also what were perfectly constitutional state attempts to intervene in the economy. Although the court remained committed to its traditional limited government and federalism-dominated jurisprudence in 1935 and 36, there were already by that time harbingers of things to come. That is, there already had been some rulings from the court during the Roosevelt administration that gave an inkling of what the court was ultimately going to do in response to the New Deal. The first of those came in the Minnesota case of Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell. When I was a law student at the University of Texas School of Law, one of my one of the people who most influenced my intellectual development was a law professor there named Lino Graglia. Graglia was an expert in antitrust law and constitutional law, and especially the law of race in the schools. But he also had, of course, opinions about the Supreme Court's behavior generally in the 20th century. And I well recall him saying that there had only been one time in American history when somebody brought to the Supreme Court a state statute that actually violated the U.S. Constitution as originally understood. That is, there was only one time in its history up to that point, and this was in the late 80s up to 1990, that the Supreme Court had actually considered a state statute that was unconstitutional. And in that case, Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell, the court upheld the statute. Now, on what ground did it uphold the statute? Well, what had happened was that there had been a moratorium placed by the legislature of Minnesota on home foreclosures in Minnesota. And the reason is easily understood. There had been a lot of farm foreclosures. And this was a predictable result of the decline in prices of agricultural goods and concomitant decline in farmers' ability to meet their mortgage payments. So the legislature of Minnesota responded to its constituents' demands by passing a law effectively saying that there wouldn't be farm foreclosures in Minnesota. The court in Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell reasoned that, well, the Contracts Clause of Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, which bars states from passing any law that impairs the obligation of contract, was not intended for an emergency situation such as this. And because there wasn't an economic emergency, the court said, this is a perfectly reasonable kind of statute. Of course, what this all left aside was that the economic circumstances that would tend to induce a Republican legislature to pass a foreclosure moratorium were bad economic times. So during the 1770s and 80s, when the revolution was being fought and immediately after, there had been in every single state what were in those days called stay laws. That is to say, a law like the one Virginia adopted at one point, saying for the next 6 months in Virginia, no farm foreclosures. And Federalists, people who were proponents of the U.S. Constitution, such as James Madison, argued that this kind of law was both unjust and ultimately counterproductive for everybody. Why was it unjust? Well, it was unjust because a lender had a right to expect that his loan would be repaid as scheduled in the contract, and he also had a right to think that he would be able to enforce that expectation in court. This was precisely the kind of situation that the Contracts Clause was intended to address. Secondly, it was ultimately, people like Madison thought, counterproductive for everybody because if lenders, if people who had money to lend got into the or came to understand that the legislature was going to prevent them from enforcing contracts to loan money, then they were going to cease loaning money in that jurisdiction. And so Madison thought it was extremely important that the Constitution include a provision like the Contracts Clause. Otherwise, the Republican legislature would tend simply to take money from wealthy people and give it to poor people, or anytime a political opportunist could point to somebody with more money who was wanting to collect his debt from a person with less money, it would be possible for some demagogue to go out and say, well, this shouldn't happen, not here in Minnesota, and have this kind of law passed. So, as Gralia said, the Home Building and Loan Association versus Blaisdell involved a statute that was egregiously unconstitutional, clearly exactly the kind of statute that the provision in the Constitution was intended to ban, and perhaps predictably, the court upheld the statute. The other harbinger of things to come was in a case called Nebbia versus New York. In New York, the price of milk had come to strike people as objectionably high. And again, what's going on in general is that people have less money to spend, their wages are falling, their yields of money from selling their crops are falling, and so they go to their state legislature and say, milk's essential, you should cap the price. This was clearly a counterproductive kind of policy where you cap prices, you end up with shortages, but or you end up with less production and people have less to consume. But not the same as saying shortages. But in the Depression, this kind of law was commonly adopted. Now, what the court did in this case was allow the price cap. So, although we might say that this is based on faulty economic thinking, it was constitutional for New York to adopt this foolish policy, and for a change, again, evidently prodded by the idea that there was this economic emergency, the court allowed the state to do what the Constitution, clearly under the 10th Amendment, had left it power to do, which was to cap the price of milk. So that was a step away from the long-standing habit of the Supreme Court to say that the liberty of contract left it up to individuals selling and buying to decide on prices, and in that sense, it was a harbinger of what was about to come. After his re-election in 1936, Franklin Roosevelt decided that he had had enough of the Supreme Court as a brake on the adoption of what were these clearly unconstitutional statutes that the Democratic Party in the House, in the Congress, and he as president were trying to enact into law. And so before he took the oath of office the second time, Roosevelt, on February 5th, 1937, announced his court packing plan. And of course, he did not call it his court packing plan, but this is what basically everybody called it at the time and has called it since. And what Roosevelt said was that it seemed obvious to him that there were several justices on the Supreme Court who were just too old for the job. He felt sorry for them and their dotage, and he wanted the opportunity to appoint additional justices who could help them get their work done. The idea here, obviously, was to intimidate the Supreme Court into changing the outcomes in cases about these New Deal laws, transferring power from Congress to the president, transferring power from the states to the central government. And at the time that Roosevelt made the announcement of his court packing plan, there were actually five justices on the Supreme Court who were only 7 years, who were over 70 years old. Among them were the chief opponents of his on the Supreme Court. So Roosevelt hoped, maybe, or at least he said he wanted, for Congress to pass legislation empowering him to appoint as many as five justices to pick up the slack. Well, the chief justice wrote to the president and said, "I'm not aware that there's any slack. I don't think there's anybody on the court who's unable to fulfill his tasks or perform his tasks, fulfill his duties." And there was a serious backlash against Roosevelt for making this proposal. But whatever the reason was, there soon would be, as pundits, or should we say wags at the time, called it, the switch in time that saved nine. Justice Roberts, one of the people who had been somewhat consistently voting that the New Deal measures were unconstitutional, soon after the announcement of the court packing plan, changed his vote, began aligning with the Roosevelt appointees on the court and upholding the New Deal legislation. And soon enough, Roosevelt would have enough appointees on the court that he basically could rely on them to uphold what he was doing. But Roberts' switch in time was alleged to have saved nine, and that is supposed to have been the origin of what scholars have since called the Revolution of 1937. Now, G. Edward White, the legal and constitutional historian at the University of Virginia, in his fine book on the Supreme Court and New Deal, has argued that there were indications that Roberts was going to go this way before the switch in time. That is, according to White, it really was not so substantial a break in Justice Roberts' jurisprudence as it seemed to people to be at the time. And whatever the argument you want to accept here, whether you want to buy that Roberts was already kind of tending in this direction before he switched, or whether you want to say, as seems more likely to me, since they had been consistently striking down the main New Deal bills and now began upholding them, significant change did occur in 1937. The first indication of this change came in a case called West Coast Hotel Company versus Parrish in 1937. And what happened here was that, evidently on the ground that minors and women were less well equipped to bargain for themselves in the labor market, Washington State had passed a minimum wage law for such people. In West Coast Hotel Company versus Parrish, the court upheld the law. That is, it overturned Morehead. It got rid of the whole liberty of contract doctrine, which was an epical change, a very significant change, especially as regarded state legislation, and began allowing the state governments to pass labor laws regarding minimum wage, maximum hours, conditions of labor, and so on, that they had been saying were unconstitutional before. This clearly was a movement in the direction of actually upholding the Constitution. On the other hand, we can't say that about the next of these elements of the Revolution of 1937, the court's decision in National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation in 1937. What happened here was that the Congress had passed what was called the National Labor Relations Act, which empowered the president to appoint what was called the National Labor Relations Board, and those people then set conditions of labor. This was a pro-union bill, a pro-union statute, And union laborers were one significant component of Roosevelt's New Deal coalition, which was made up essentially of Northern ethnics, union members, Southern segregationists, and a couple of other groups. And here the union supporters got their element of the New Deal. The court upheld NLRB versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation and allowed the federal government's executive branch to regulate essentially labor contracts in a way that previously they had not been allowed to do. The next element of the revolution of 1937 was the court's decision in Helvering versus Davis. What this did was to uphold the Social Security Act, uphold the Social Security program. This program amounts, as we know now, to taxing current workers to pay for the retirement of current beneficiaries, but it was sold to people at the time as a kind of old age insurance that you were going to pay for while you were working and then receive the benefits of after you retired. It, of course, does not work that way. And in fact, the politicians have virtually from the beginning spent every nickel in FICA receipts as they had them in their hands, and essentially just said, "Well, we're making out an IOU here. We'll pay you Tuesday for this hamburger today," more or less. The court found that the General Welfare Clause of Article 1, Section 8, which is a statement at the beginning of Article 1, Section 8, that the Congress can pass taxes, tariffs, duties, excises. These are all synonyms, more or less. In order to provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare, that was a substantive grant of power. Before, people like James Madison had argued that the General Welfare Clause was just a kind of preamble to the list of powers in Article 1, Section 8. So people like Madison said, well, here we have a list in Article 1, Section 8 of, depending how you count, 17 or 18 powers of Congress. It wouldn't make any sense to say Congress can do whatever it thinks is conducive to the general welfare, plus it can coin money, it can regulate weights and measures, it can regulate trade with the Indians. Clearly, all those things would have been among the things a member of Congress might have argued were conducive to the general welfare. So if the General Welfare Clause had been a substantive grant of power, there wouldn't have been any need for the enumeration, and the enumeration seemed to indicate that the General Welfare Clause was just a statement that these following powers are to be used for the general good. But the court said in 1937's Helvering decision that although there was nothing in the Constitution saying Congress could adopt something like the Social Security Act or implement something such as this policy of providing more or less a transfer of wealth from current employees and other workers to older people, yet the General Welfare Clause provided a kind of constitutional cover for this anyway. It was a substantive grant of power. And basically, once you had this decision on the books, it was going to be possible to argue that Congress could do almost anything as long as it could claim, well, this is for the general welfare. And Congress would never adopt a bill and not say it was for the general welfare. What was the Supreme Court going to do if it was going to get out of the business of policing the boundary of congressional authority? Well, the answer to that question became clear in the most famous footnote in the history of the Supreme Court, that in the case of U.S. versus Caroline Products Company in 1938, in footnote 4. If you mention to a constitutional scholar or a constitutional historian, if you ask, what do you think of footnote 4? Everybody will know which footnote 4 that is. So there have been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases with footnote 4s in them, but the footnote 4 is the one in Caroline Products. And what the court said in that case was that from that point on, it was going to be the special defender of the Bill of Rights and of discrete and insular minorities, as the court put it, besides of the Republican political process. So the court is announcing it's going to get out of the business of saying that we have essentially a federal system with a few powers in the central government and most in the more local state governments, And now it's going to leave up to Congress to legislate on essentially anything it wants to, but the Congress is not going to see the Supreme Court just fold up its tent and go home. Instead, what the Supreme Court is going to do is to identify quote unquote discrete and insular minorities who are going to receive its special protection, besides which it's also going to strive to ensure that the Republican political process is allowed to function. In 1941, in U.S. versus Darby, the court upheld a minimum wage and maximum hours law at the federal level. And again, there was nothing in the Constitution that said that the Supreme Court should do this, so that Congress had power to adopt such legislation before. This was the kind of thing that was always held to be intrastate and thus not covered by the Interstate Commerce Clause. But as I said, the court by 1941 was no longer in the business actually of enforcing the Constitution, or certainly of enforcing the 10th Amendment, or the idea that Congress should have only a few powers. The apotheosis, the ultimate carrying something to its absurd extreme in this whole line of cases, came in 1942's decision in the case of Wickard versus Filburn. What happened here was that a farmer was growing wheat on his own farm for his own consumption, and ultimately the federal executive took him to court and said that he had violated new federal guidelines limiting the amount of wheat he could produce. He said, in his own defense, or I should say his attorney said, well, yes, it's true that he was growing wheat and consuming it, but this has nothing to do with interstate commerce, and so it doesn't fall under Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. The court ultimately said, well, it is true, or may be true, that this defendant was not engaged in interstate commerce, but Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce extends to any activity that affects interstate commerce. And you can see that there's a huge difference between whatever's in interstate commerce and what might affect it. And you could argue that virtually anything that anybody did ultimately could have an effect on interstate commerce. And so this would be a door through which Congress could walk in its in following the impulse to legislate about every area of American life. There's virtually nothing that Congress couldn't do if it could regulate anything that might tend to affect interstate commerce. And ultimately, we're going to see that it's going to be over 5 decades from Wickard to the next time that the Supreme Court says that Congress has exceeded the limits of its power under the Interstate Commerce Clause. So between 1942 and 1995, every time the Congress said we're adopting this law in exercise of our powers under the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Supreme Court allowed it.